From Brown Cow Studios in Gallatin Gateway, Montana, this is News Nerds. I'm Ezra Graham. Today, we talk to forensic pathologist Warner Spitz. Dr. Spitz is 96, but shows no signs of retirement. As we'll find out, he wouldn't even want to retire on his 100th birthday in 2026, and has a good sense of humor about it. Spitz was born in what was then Germany and is now Poland in 1926 to Jewish parents, and moved to France early in Hitler's rise to power. The family moved to Israel, where Spitz would later receive an MD. After he moved to the US, Werner worked as a forensic pathologist in Maryland and in Michigan, where he's based now. Over his career, Spitz has worked on the cases of JFK, MLK, JonBenet Ramsey, Nicole Brown Simpson, and others. He's also a co-author of the textbook, Medical Legal Investigation of Death, an over 700-page tome written to help new forensic pathologists and the police. The book's in its fifth edition, and it now contains color photographs and has gotten rave reviews from many, including David Sedaris. We'll talk about the structure of forensic pathology, Werner's family, and his career. It's Wednesday, May 31st, and this is News Nerds. Before we start the interview, Werner and Diane, his left-hand woman, who has been working with Dr. Spitz since the 1970s, left me with a written answer to one of my questions.
We have a very nice restaurant here, and we went yesterday. I took her to the to that restaurant, and we had a nice meal. Where I dictated the answer to that first question. That took about an hour to do. So at the same time, we had a nice meal.
Well, thank you so much for doing that. I'm going to read you his response right now. And by the way, I think that this serves as a great introduction to, you know, his whole life. It goes from the beginning of his childhood to, you know, his practice in pathology now. So here's what he wrote. Quote, I left Germany with my parents when I was 6 or 7 and went to Paris to spend the next 6 months with my aunt and her family without my parents, while my parents returned to Germany to finish packing the household, just to avoid me from the turmoil of moving. I spoke perfect French when my parents returned and picked me up, and went by ship 8 days to Palestine and settled in Tel Aviv, where my father started a medical practice, and I went to school in Hebrew. I had no knowledge of Hebrew until then. It is interesting that my mother found out on the ship to Palestine that there were 2,000 passengers on the ship. 900 of them were physicians, all escaping the Nazis. When my parents arrived in Palestine, my mother learned to speak Arabic, which very quickly resulted in my father, who never spoke anything but German, very rapidly using my mother to be the interpreter for an almost entirely Arabic clientele. I was accepted and went to medical school in Geneva, Switzerland, and then finished with an MD degree from the Hebrew University, Hadassah Medical School in Jerusalem, in 1953. I got notice from the Israeli army to immediately return to join the forces to fight the Arabs, who had declared war on the Jewish state. After 6 days, they lost the war, and I received a cable that I need not come. But I went anyway and became an officer in the Israeli Defense Forces for obligatory 2.5 years. My parents went back to Frankfurt, Germany, and I took over my father's practice. After a while, I wrote to a number of medical examiners and coroner's offices about a job in forensic pathology. 12 years later, I went to America to visit for 1 year the country of Big Brother. At that time, I soon found out that forensic pathology in this country was in its infancy. When President Kennedy was assassinated, I was on a ship returning from Germany to the States. In fact, the ship on which I was traveling was 100 miles outside of the New York Harbor. I became Americanized during that year, and then some, and I have now been in this country 63 years. I am now 96 and still working, in the last few years in private practice of forensic pathology. I will probably retire if God thinks like me. He will take me on August 22nd, 2026. At that time, I will request an extension to enable me to continue working, doing autopsies, rendering opinions, and testifying in courts across the country, as I have been all along and having a wonderful time in America." Unquote. So I'm going to go ahead and play you the interview, and we started up by talking about his parents, his time in Europe and the Middle East, and the Holocaust and the Nazi era.
I was born in Germany, and now that city where I was born is was returned with a whole long sliver of all of Germany was given back to Poland as reparations after the war, after the World War, Second World War. Today, if I wanted to, I would get a Polish passport, but I didn't take a Polish passport. I received a German passport. They returned it because they realized that they actually took my passport away when I was 6 or 7, when my parents came and took me to Paris, where my aunt lived, my aunt and her family. Husband and one kid. They're all dead by now. That part where I was born was given back to Poland, because at one point it belonged to Poland. But when I was born, it was Germany. And I went there with some friends of mine some years ago. But we went there to see the place where I was born. They were interested to see where I was born. I said, what is there to be seen about this? We want to see where you were born. I said, okay, well, then let's go. So we went there. I was born in a house exactly across a large cobblestone place where every Friday merchants would come with their produce and sell that to the area people. And there would be like similar, I don't know if you know Detroit, there's a similar place here in Detroit where there's a large area, very large, with restaurants, and people come with their merchandise and sell that. They grow vegetables, they sell meat, it's called, let me see, hold on. Hey, Diane? Oh, she doesn't know. We don't, we're not very, very okay. Frequently going there. But that's Eastern Market, yes. Market. Eastern Market. Yeah. Are you talking about Eastern Market? Yeah, I'm talking about Eastern Market. So that's why I went to Germany. I could have gone perhaps to Israel. Uh-huh. Well, I was in Israel. It would have been simpler. But at the same time, I thought to myself, well, it gives me the opportunity of escaping Israel in the summertime because it gets very hot. Have you heard about the Kristallnacht? There was a night when that was the beginning of the Nazi era, when they threw rocks at Jewish shops all over Germany, at homes of bankers and lawyers and owners of big shops like department stores and stuff like that that belonged to Jews. They threw rocks and broke the windows, broke into apartments and looted them, and was unbelievable. Gradually, Jews were sent to concentration camps. I had two uncles that by that time we were in Israel, and we did not stay in Germany. My parents left. My mother was Latvian, and my mother went back home from Germany to see her father, who was dying of stomach cancer. And he said to her from his deathbed, he said, "I suggest that you leave Germany now." What kind of thing are you telling me? She said to him. She went with me. I was a kid. And at one point, it will be that you will not be able to leave. And that's exactly what happened. And she went back and said to my father, if we don't leave now, my father says this will end up very bad for us. So that's why they left. He predicted all that. Her father, she was a young woman when she got married. She was, I don't know, something like 20. And I was born in 26. In those days, you got married early. That's what happened.
Well, how did your career in forensic pathology originally start in Europe?
Well, it's a long question. It's because you're not aware of what the answer really is. I went to Germany in 1961 and spent 2 years at what you would consider an equivalent to an American coroner's or medical examiner's office. Why did I go? People can come to America by just jumping the fence in their center house. That's how I would do it now when I know what I do know. I would now fly to Europe, then go to Mexico, fly to Mexico, and then arrive in Mexico City, take a plane to the south of the United States, somewhere near Dallas or somewhere like that, in the proximity of Dallas, Texas, take a cab, be driven to the border, and then jump the fence. That would be the simplest. You don't even need to do that. You just walk around there, and then when nobody's looking, maybe you would cross the border. It's crazy what's going on down in the South. I came to America as a visitor, and I knew the consul because a lot of people come to Israel to see the holy places. Every time somebody came to see the holy places and died, sometimes these are old people. They die. Some die when they come here to when I come to Israel, and as a visitor, the consulate, by the way, was where my parents lived and my father practiced in Tel Aviv.
They were both in the medical profession.
Yeah, both my father and my mother. They are not alive anymore, but they. You're right. Yes, they were both physicians, and my sister was a physician as well, but she died of a ruptured aneurysm. The consul would come to the medical examiner's office in Tel Aviv and be present when the body of the deceased person is placed in a metal coffin, then be welded shut then the consul would place a stamp of the United States on the welding, on the welded coffin, and you wouldn't be able to mess around with that. He would come there and he'd say, "Hi, Werner." George or whatever his name was. And we became good friends. And I came there to the consulate and I said, George, I need a visa. Oh, welcome to America, he said. So I said, well, he said to me, what visa do you want? I said, well, any visa. He said, well, they said, take an immigration visa. I said, no, I don't want an immigration visa. Because I asked my boss, I had a stipend from the Israeli government that I could go to America, but I would have to be back before the end of 1 year. And I said, well, why is that? He said, the answer was, because you're not going to come back, and we're going to lose you, and we don't want to lose you. And I said, how do you know that I won't come back? How do you know what I will do? I don't know what I'll do. And he said, we know you. And your boss said that he thinks you're not going to get back. And I said, well, thank you very much. I consider that a compliment, but the way I reason is that I will probably come back. But therefore, I took a visitor's visa. He said, okay. I came here on a visitor's visa and not on an immigration visa.
Maybe we could talk a bit about how pathology and forensic pathology is different in the U.S. from Europe. When you got to the U.S., what did you see as the difference between forensic pathology between Europe and the U.S.?
Forensic pathology in Europe, and that's not Israel. Israel is in the Middle East. The European system is the same all over. It is a university appointment where retired forensic pathologists in Europe, when they retire, they become deans and other highly regarded positions in the field of medicine. The German and other European countries, they consider forensic pathology medicine. They consider that as medicine. Yeah, this medicine. But it's a very specialized type of medicine. Because you work with high-ranking police officers.
Right.
And that's what they do in America, too. But in America, it is very helpful to the police. They come and they ask questions and you may have heard of JonBenet Ramsey.
Yes.
Well, JonBenet Ramsey, the police came here from Boulder, Colorado, and they filled my ears. One day they came, I came to work, and I found them here in my office. At 9 o'clock they were here, and they left at midnight. The knowledge in Europe is very academic, which in the States is not so. In the States, they want, in some places, like for instance, Albuquerque is the seat of the medical examiner's office for the whole state of New Mexico. That position is academic, it's part of the university. My resident, Dr. Smilak, died some years ago of some heart problem. When he finished his residency of 1 year in forensic pathology, after he passed the academic part, the American Board of Pathology exam, so then he wanted to take the forensic board examinations. the boards in pathology, hospital pathology. Well, so he did, and he passed, and then he took the board examinations, and no sooner did he do that, he received an appointment at the pathology department of the university. And the head pathologist, the one in charge there, was also chief medical examiner for the state. And he wanted John Smilak to write papers. And John said, if I am to do autopsies for the state of New Mexico, then I cannot also write papers because that takes too much time. It takes me away from working for the police. They fell out, and so he left. He became chief in Baltimore, where I was when I met Dr. Fisher.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to get to your book that you co-wrote with Dr. Fisher. It's called Medical Legal Investigation of Death, and you were describing it to me as a textbook. It's in its fifth edition. Can you explain what the book is, what the purpose of
The book is used by anybody who wants to learn forensic pathology. There are a lot of people who have an interest in this death and dying and how and why and so on is a very much on the interest list to the general public. It's amazing how anybody would want to read a book like that, because if you look at the pictures, you'll soon realize how different that book is from other books. This book is there for finding criminals, not for daily consumption. It's not a kind of book that you want to lay on the coffee table when friends or relatives come to visit you on a Sunday afternoon, or either reading in the evening before you go to sleep and you dream about what you read. It's not that kind of a book. But it's a very good book because it's academic and meant to help the police understand what happened in this case from the medical standpoint.
I see. What is your job like right now? What's a daily schedule for you now?
What I like in my job, it's like being a medical policeman. Well, not exactly, there isn't such a thing, but it involves chemistry. We are now here in the States as a whole in an epidemic. A lot of deaths occur from overdose, and sometimes not from overdose, just by the ingestion of drugs that depress the respiration, which are addictive drugs like heroin and morphine and opiates in general. And people die by hordes. I mean, you must have heard of young men and women who spend lots of money on buying drugs that are poisonous. And I mean, that is kind of ridiculous. Young people, 18, 19, 20, in the 20s, America loses a lot of people like that. Yeah.
You've said that being in the presence of a dead body is easier than being in the presence of a grieving person. Can you explain this?
Oh, yes. Well because I'm very emotional. I had gone with Diane to Chicago to do an autopsy on the owner of the Bears. What's that, a football team? We were coming back, and I let her off in a town called Romulus. And I continued to Grosse Pointe, where we lived. And after I was at home for like 10 or 15 minutes, she called me and said, there's been a plane crash. I said, really? What, a big plane? She said, yes, a big plane. And I said, okay, I'll come and see what I can do for them. And that's when I found out that they gave me a vest, you know, so that to be identified as part of the team. As it turned out, I was in charge of that team. It took me 5 days to get everybody identified. I did no autopsies. In my view, I didn't need autopsies. Who did I autopsy? The pilot and the co-pilot. Those were the only two that I autopsied out of the 156 people that had to be identified. And we identified everybody in 5 days. The county came to the airport and asked me, what do you need to do to work this up? I said, I need 156 tables, wooden sawhorses, I call them. Do you know what that is?
Yeah.
Where the bodies were completely destroyed. They were the people that... There were people who were not destroyed, but there were a lot of people that were destroyed. I would not have been able to identify them by facial identification. So those people were identified differently. But essentially, it needed a forensic pathologist to do that. So I did it. I had a lot of help with a lot of people that helped me, from funeral homes and from hospitals, from pathology departments. They would do what I tell them. And then I had a team of dentists because it was dental identification. And I would go over this with them. After they finished, I would ask questions so to make sure, because I was the one responsible for that. Not for the crash, but for who was who.
How do you separate your work life from the rest of your life?
Well, one thing is true. I put my work ahead of my family life. I have three kids. Two of them are doctors. One of them is a forensic pathologist who is the chief medical examiner of a county here in this area of in the area of Detroit. I have another fellow who is hospital surgeon, and he operates on people. And he always amazes me because he's an excellent surgeon, and he does mainly laparoscopic surgery, where he makes three little holes in the patient and puts in camera into the belly, and the machine does what he pushes on buttons on a long rod, metal rod. I am in awe of this. He says to me, you know, you never saw me do surgery. I said, no, I didn't. He came to visit his parents from Chicago, where he worked. Now he's in Washington State, and he doesn't come too often. And I said to him, you know, Jonathan, I'm really impressed with that, what you're doing. I love to see more of this, but I need to get back.
Do you ever plan to retire?
No, I don't want to retire. I don't want to retire. I want to retire when I cannot thinking. I know what I want. I came to America to work as a medical examiner, somebody who does the things that are required by law, that is, determine cause of death, determine manner of death, meaning homicide, suicide, natural causes, or accident. And maybe if I cannot determine, you ask me one question, if I don't know what somebody died of, what do you do then? Well, then I have to be courageous and say I was unable to find the cause of death. And if I cannot find it, somebody else cannot find it either. So it's not always easy to find the cause of death.
Right.
So most of the time, it's about 1% of cases you don't find the cause of death.
Uh-huh. Thank you so much. That was my interview with forensic pathologist Werner Spitz. News Nerds is produced and hosted by me. We're on the web at newsnerdspodcast.com, where you can catch up with past episodes, subscribe to our newsletter, play our past daily mini crosswords, and contact us. Find News Nerds on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, and while you're there, please leave us a review. We're also on community radio station KGVM every other week at 5:30 p.m. Mountain Time. They're at kgvm.org or 95.9 FM on your radio. Consider supporting them by going to kgvm.org/support-kgvm. Thank you and see you next week.